few kinds of fungus have earned the gastronomic respect of the chanterelle. Prized for its flavor and aroma, the chanterelle is a summertime treat that Wisconsin Life commentator Brett Laidlaw looks forward to every year.
When the summer has been warm and wet, I start to look for them the first week in July. In the deep shade of oaky slopes, they push up through the thick mat of dead leaves, bursts of gold and orange erupting from the drab duff. You spot one by a rotting log, catch a corner of another down the hill, and then a cluster in the moss. Scanning farther, you observe a thrilling constellation of brilliant fungi spreading out across the forest floor. It's a minor miracle of the mushroom world, the fruiting of Cantharellus cibarius, the golden chanterelle. Morels get all the attention of mushroom lovers in these parts, but chanterelles are just as delicious. Maybe they're overlooked because they appear in midsummer, when a trip into the hot, humid woods can be a bit harrowing. To reach my favorite chanterelle grounds, I wade through a sea of vicious nettles, fight through thorny fortifications of prickly ash and blackberry razor wire, all the while swatting away mosquitoes and deer flies. Once I've run this gauntlet, I stop and take a deep breath, clear my bleary eyes. As many times as I've stood in this exact spot, knowing exactly what I'm looking for, it's never less than a total thrill to spot the first golden furl glinting in the oak leaves. I drop to my knees and cut the stem just above the ground. Bringing the mushroom right up to my nose, I inhale. Shivers run up my arms and neck. The scent of the chanterelle is often compared to apricots, but it also reminds me of fresh sweet corn sliced from the cob or a fragrant pumpkin cracked open with a big sharp knife. Mainly, they smell like chanterelles, haunting and unique. They're wonderful to look at, too. The stem swells gracefully toward the cap, the underside of which is lined with delicate, irregularly forking veins. Their color ranges from pale cream through sunny yellow to deep, vibrant orange. It's like nothing else in the mushroom world. In cooking chanterelles, the best you can do is the least. Sauté them in good butter and spoon them onto a piece of toast. Cook up a classic French omelet of the freshest eggs. Sauté sliced chanterelles with a bit of minced shallot, and you have a sunny plate of utter simplicity and deliciousness, well worth the trek into the summer forest.
Now, our next guest really loves mushrooms. So much, in fact, that he's spent his career as a mycologist, that's a mushroom scientist, and he's written several books on the subject.
Nicholas Money is a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio, and his most recent book is Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to talk with you, Judith.
I think when most of us think of mushrooms, we think of what pops up above the ground, especially in damp and shady areas. In your terms, what is a mushroom?
Well, mushrooms are fruit bodies, or we might say that they're the sex organs that are produced by microorganisms that spread through soil or rotting wood in the form of these microscopic filaments. But those filaments can span over an enormous territory. So the structures that are produced above ground then are these, as I've said, the fruit bodies, and their function is to produce and release spores, which they do beautifully. That mushrooms are veritable spore factories, and that's one thing that I've done in my research career and working with students over the years is looking at actually how that works. And I think I'm still mesmerized by the efficiency of this process.
Well, and it's so interesting because they take advantage of a variety of elements and creatures around them to help them in their efforts to reproduce and to spread those spores. So I'm remembering that they use wind, they use water, they use birds, they use animals.
Yeah, there is this amazing diversity of mechanisms that have evolved among the mushroom-forming fungi for getting their spores dispersed. And so, as you say, wind is certainly one of the dominant modes of transmission. But yeah, mushrooms also interact with all kinds of other organisms, forest creatures, and all the way from, you know, nematode worms and rodents and insects, lots of insects, and to also participate in dispersing their spores. So often when scientists talk about mushrooms, they're really referring to the fruit bodies produced by a particular group of fungi called the Basidiomycetes. There's another group of fungi called the Ascomycetes, and those include the fungi that produce morels and truffles. But there's also Basidiomycetes, so things that other normally would form gills that also form mushrooms form fruit bodies called false truffles, and they operate really just like truffles. So that they rely upon being unearthed by mammals and actually dispersed after those mammals consume them.
So you've kind of pointed to this a little already, but how diverse is the world of mushrooms?
So there's about, if we think about, again, these two different groups then in which larger fruit bodies are produced, then there's at least 16,000 species of Basidiomycete fungi that form mushrooms, and a smaller number of the Ascomycetes, but probably we're just looking at a small number of the actual diversity of species in nature then that form mushrooms. There's relatively few scientists that are engaged in finding and identifying new species of mushrooms, and so there's pretty good reason to think that a lot of this diversity has gone unrecorded at this point.
And do we have a sense, Nick, of how long mushrooms have existed?
So the fossil record's kind of interesting. The fossil record is beautiful, but very, very incomplete. So there's whole fruit bodies that have been preserved in amber, and these are absolutely beautiful, beautiful fossils of tiny mushrooms, tiny fruit bodies in amber. They can be dated going back perhaps as far as, the time of the dinosaurs. But the thing with those mushrooms is that they already look much like the mushrooms that we'd find in the woods today. So this suggests that their evolutionary history stretches back much farther than this. But we really, really don't know. But we're probably thinking in terms of a couple of 100 million years.
And what you're saying about the fossil record in reading your book, it made total sense, but I hadn't thought about it before, that just the type of organism that mushrooms are, they don't lend themselves to fossilization very well.
That's right. And there's been this immense extinction that's occurred throughout the evolutionary history of the mushrooms, and today we're left with mushrooms. It's very, very difficult to figure out the relationships between these different mushrooms when there's been such extinction and that the fossil record is so poor.
Nicholas Money is a mycologist and a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio. We're talking with him about his most recent book, Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Nicholas Money. He's a mycologist, and his most recent book is Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History.
Let's talk a little bit about that cultural history now, because there are so many amazing things about mushrooms that they really lend themselves to a lot of superstitions and folk beliefs. And one that I just really enjoyed reading about was fairy circles. First, when we talk about fairy circles and mushrooms, what are people referring to?
So mushrooms, what happens when a mushroom colony develops then is that it begins as a single spore. And that these filaments that I've mentioned earlier, then they're growing out in all directions, sort of like spokes on a bicycle wheel, and that colony gets ever larger, and it has a roughly circular shape. And when the fruit bodies are formed, then those are generated around the circumference of that circle, and this is what gives the appearance then of a fairy ring.
And they can pop up overnight.
They can pop up very quickly, yes. That what's happening there is that the fruit bodies are developing underground, and they form a primordium, a little nugget of tissue. But then that expands very, very rapidly by absorbing water. And so one can wake up in the morning and look out on a lawn and see mushrooms that were invisible on the previous day. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, this idea that they're associated with so many myths and legends and superstitions. I mean, on the one hand, this perhaps makes people, excites people about mushrooms. But the trouble is, too, that they've become associated with so many supernatural doings that it also leads people to think that they're sort of a bizarre part of nature. Mm.
Well, I have to say, your book, I've always thought mushrooms were interesting, but your book really did suck me in and get me really interested in. And one of the things that I didn't realize about mushrooms is that some of them have bioluminescence, so they actually glow. And how has that played into some of the beliefs and superstitions about mushrooms?
Yeah, so exactly. So that's one of the sources of superstitions about mushrooms and other fungi, then, is the fact that they glow in the dark. And there's been some beautiful research done on these bioluminescent mushrooms in recent years, particularly by some researchers in Brazil. And so it turns out there's a much greater diversity of mushrooms that will luminesce. And in tropical forests, for example. And the function of this is really not well understood, but it could be related to the attraction of insects, and that those insects might play an important role in dispersing spores. But on just another level, it is a remarkable phenomenon to actually see mushrooms glowing in the dark, and there's a few species in North America that do this, and it's a wondrous phenomenon.
There are some, how should we say it, some similarities between some mushrooms and some human sexual organs. I'm guessing that too has led to some interesting beliefs or thoughts about mushrooms.
Yes, absolutely. So certainly phallic mushrooms have always been I suppose, since we emerged from the Rift Valley, but humans have always been remarked upon the similarity in shape, perhaps, between certain mushrooms and parts of the human anatomy.
And have there been beliefs relating to, say, mushrooms being able to help with virility, for instance?
So absolutely. So the doctrine of signatures types of ideas, then, that by consuming these mushrooms, at least in their primordial or egg stage, that maybe this can act as that they have aphrodisiacal properties. Yeah.
How long have humans been talking about mushrooms and writing about mushrooms?
So the mushrooms are mentioned in a number of the classical works by authors like Pliny, and so yes, they were certainly the subject of the Romans there were many mushrooms that were used in Russian did I say Russian Roman cuisine and Russian
and
cuisine
Russian
also,
cuisine actually quite, I can vouch for that
quite that far back but yes, so. But they were also interested in potentially the medicinal properties of mushrooms. So, and they certainly appear in Roman art, in frescoes, and so forth. So, yeah, those are the earliest written accounts that we're aware of.
And were people eating mushrooms for pleasure that far back?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Things like Caesar's mushroom, a species of Amanita, appears to have been eaten for a long, long time, many, many centuries, yeah.
And there are some mushrooms that can be very, very dangerous. They can be fatal or can make you extremely sick. What percentage would you say of mushroom varieties fall into that category?
Yeah, well, it's a minority of mushrooms that are truly dangerous, but one has to be exceedingly careful because there are some lookalikes. One, that you can find a mushroom, and well, many people have, of course, made this the last error of their lives by misidentifying a mushroom, but this is a minority of species, and if any of your listeners actually can get out into the field with a local mushroom group, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things that mushroom societies can do, is actually educate people so that they can correctly identify mushrooms, or at least recognize the really bad ones, the things to avoid.
So there are medicinal mushrooms, but then, and maybe there's some crossover, there are also hallucinogenic mushrooms. What is it about those mushrooms that have that effect on human beings?
So there's a lot of interest in hallucinogenic mushrooms right now, and in particular those that contain a compound called psilocybin. And these magic mushrooms, indeed, that they're not legally, but they are cultivated for human consumption. But
there is actually research going on here at the University of Wisconsin exactly on that.
Yeah, and so there have been some remarkable studies published on the effectiveness of compounds, psilocybin in particular, that gets converted to a compound called psilocin after we consume this. That this has remarkable effects on mood elevation. But I mean, this is clinically very significant. That there's this there's a study just published in the last few months showing that consuming at least the purified compound then produced by these mushrooms can be very effective at sort of rebooting people that have been suffering from very severe clinical depression, and this can perhaps put them on a different path. This is really interesting. So it could be useful in sort of palliative care, end of life care, and perhaps in many other circumstances too.
The last chapter of your book focuses on mushroom conservation, and I'm not sure mushrooms are one of the first things that come to mind when we think about protecting natural resources. Make the case for us, Nick.
Oh, make the case for conserving mushrooms. I suppose it begins with the fact of the hideousness of our species and the way in which we have and are continuing at an accelerating rate to reshape the biosphere, and mushrooms are among the organisms that we are endangering or threatening through those activities. That so obviously, if you think about clear cutting of forests, obviously the trees are gone, but also the fungi that supported those trees are disappearing. So this is some, as a mycologist, I'd rather see more mushrooms and fewer human beings, but perhaps that won't resonate with every member of your audience. But also actually that we impact mushrooms through picking them. And this is a somewhat controversial issue when you think about individuals picking for their own kitchen. But the real problems, I think, come when we think about commercial picking, where people are going into areas and picking every last fruit body and doing this season after season. And so we're engaged in an experiment right now to just look at the effects of, not a controlled experiment, but looking, we will see the effects of commercial harvesting of mushrooms on the health of those populations over the coming decades.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for talking with us and for sharing your passion for mushrooms with us.
Thank you so much.
Nicholas Money is a mycologist and a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio. His most recent book is Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History.
One of the most eagerly anticipated rites of spring here in Wisconsin is morel mushroom season. Fans of the elusive wild morel are notoriously secretive about their favorite hunting spots. You even have to get up early to find them at farmers markets because morel season is short and they're a hot commodity. Kirill Owen takes us to meet the pros, the mushroom sellers, at the Dane County Farmers Market.
I always think of them as a big inside-out nostril. I don't know if that's kind of gross or not, but... They have that kind of a porous appearance to them, I guess.
My name is Nathaniel Jones. I go out with my dad every spring, and we search for morels anywhere. Some people actually come up to the table here and say, "What are these? I've never seen them before." And we tell them they're morel mushrooms. They grow anywhere.
You want to find them where the sun shines all day. And then as the season climbs on, you change. I'm not a great hunter. My husband does all the technical stuff. He tells me where to look. I said, "You find them, I'll pick them."
Usually under dead elms is where we're finding most of ours. You know, it's like every 10th one that you look under, there's maybe or maybe not morels underneath it. It really depends. It's kind of like gambling, I guess.
Yeah, people say they only grow around dead elm trees. Well, that's not true. They grow anywhere. Matter of fact, my dad's best spot for the last 20 years was in a patch of hickories. And a little known fact about morels is that they're a super succulent. They grow during a rainstorm, similar to a cactus. There was one year that my dad was living in his trailer house in the valley. He was watching one grow. He could actually see it grow. And unfortunately, it grew about, the head was about the size of a football, but a raccoon got it before he could pick it.
They've got a meaty texture and at the same time kind of a nutty flavor. And they're wild. That's kind of almost a little mysterious, I guess. There's lots of recipes out there, but I think everybody primarily cooks them in butter. Butter, salt, and pepper.
I cut them in half. Mm-hmm. I rinse them with water. And then I fry them in olive oil and a little bit of butter.
Personally, I prefer them. We take a little butter bowl and shake them around in a bit of flour and then saute them in straight butter. I love them. It's a combination of the morel itself and the butter and the flour and the fact that you went out and did all the work to get them and everything. It's a combination of all those efforts.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.